Welcome, folks, to the RC Report. I am your host, RC Carlton. The RC Report is a part of the IBN Network, one of the many podcasts that we host on the network. Today, I have a very special treat, James Hollis from Basketball Breakdown. We're going to break down the NBA at what is relatively the halfway mark, even though it annoys me that the NBA doesn't actually stop at the actual halfway mark. But we're going to talk a little NBA trade deadline and what we see going on in the second half and reflecting on the first half. James, what's up?
Hey, what's up, brother, man? How you doing? Yeah, James Hollis of hey, I appreciate the intro, but just make sure everybody out there listening can follow us and see where we're at. It's bballbreakdown.com.
Okay. Let's get right into it and say we're looking at the trade deadlines coming up this week. And we're gonna play virtual GM. I'm gonna give you a name. You tell me if you think the team should move them or not, and then tell me what you think it would take to move this particular player. Hypothetically.
Oh boy! All right, I'll give it a try.
Okay. Dwight Howard.
The issue with Dwight, it's kind of tough because he's making a ton of money right now. I think almost 25 mil. But he's a free agent at the end of this year, so anybody who gets him is going to get him a very short-term rental. I think right now it looks like Morey wants to move him for flexibility, maybe a couple picks if he can get him in. If he can get somebody to help, that's cool. But there's talks about Boston. I don't want to see him in Boston because that's not the kind of player I think want to give assets up if you're a rebuilding team like Boston. He's somebody who wants to go to a contender. I heard talk about Charlotte. It would help them in the long run because, you know, Al Jefferson's out and they don't have much of a interior presence. So I heard the Whiteside deal. That sounds like that would probably work. They're getting, Whiteside would probably commit there long term if they like him. I'm not a big believer in Whiteside. And then for Miami, you know, it would have helped a lot, but now with Chris Bosh out, that kind of scuttles that plan too. So, yeah, they want some kind of cap flexibility. They want maybe some picks. And, of course, in a perfect world, Houston would want a young player who could contribute. But right now, I think Clint Capella can hold it down, and they did look for flexibility.
What do you think Dwight still has left in the tank? His camp seems to believe that, well, he is the fourth or fifth option, but they seem to believe it's because of a lack of touches, a lack of running the offense through him, or at least in a secondary nature. And there's James Harden's isolation tactics that are holding him down. I tend to believe he's been diminished by age and injury.
You're spot on, man. Dwight, his big calling card before was his freakish athleticism. As he's gotten older and he's dealt with the back injuries and assortment of other injuries, he's lost some of that. Every year he's missing more and more games due to nagging injuries. So he's not a polished post player. He never has been, and that's through no fault of his own. This is not who he is. But as we saw in the playoffs, he can still be game-changing defensively. He can be a dominant defensive player and change his shots, block the shots, rebounding. And, if he's still throwing up around the rim, he can still go up there and get it better than, 99% of the league. So he still offers you a good, on a good night, 17 to 22, 13 boards, a couple blocks, a lot of change shots. And when he's motivated, he can still run the floor pretty well and get up and a little transition in spurts. He can't bring it night in, night out anymore, but over a playoff series, that could be a difference maker.
All right. How about Blake Griffin?
For Blake, it's amazing because I saw somebody saying today that, for Denver to give up Gallinari, Yusuf Nurkic, and, a couple other picks, like Randy Foy and some picks would be too much. Blake Griffin is only in year six. He's only 26. He's a legitimate 25 and 12 threat every night. He can go off for 40 or 50, if you get him rolling. I think because Chris Paul is such a controlling, ball-dominant guy, and people understand this. The Clippers don't like to run. Chris Paul doesn't like to run. You get him in a fast-paced offense, and you see Blake Griffin let his skills really unfold. He's a great passer. I think his defense is better than some people think. He's still not a lockdown, but he's passable defensively. You'd have to give up a lot. We're talking, lottery picks, or we're talking two or three really high-level young guys. You have to give a lot to get Blake Griffin. So
Even the Denver deal, I heard. You know, Gallinari, he made one of those good young bigs, like Yusuf Nurkic, and a few picks, and you might have something there for Blake. But, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The thing I don't understand about this rush to trade Blake, and I guess the fight, or I don't guess you can't call it a fight, punching the trainer is not the best look. But the thing I don't understand is he's younger than Chris Paul, and if they think this to be dissolved, Blake is the one I would keep, and I would let Chris Paul go. Even though they've had this success, I think it's fool's gold based on a lot of his scheduling. And when Chris Paul was out, I guess a couple years ago, Blake was basically third in the MVP race, and he just played some of the best basketball of his career when Chris Paul was out, and we got to see all of his skills. So I don't understand why Paul isn't the one up as opposed to Blake.
And you know what? You just hit the nail on the head. If you look at the big scheme of things, he's 4 or 5 years younger. He's actually like he sells tickets. Chris Paul will win you games and sell tickets, but people will pay price of admission to come see Blake Griffin dunk. We haven't seen as much lately, but I mean, he is literally he puts on a show. So yeah, if the Clippers are feeling like they've plateaued, which I kind of feel like that's what it seems like, that they know that they're very good, but they're not the Golden State. Let's be real. They're not really even OKC. I think because of those two guys, Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant, seem like in a series it's gonna be really tough to beat them. If the Clippers are feeling like they need to do some kind of restructuring, it seems like that'd be the way to go. Is move Chris Paul, and let Blake Griffin run the show. I've been saying for a couple of years that I think that for the Clippers to take the next step, they need to find a way to let Blake Griffin take more of the load and be the guy. It's harder to win with point guards dominating the action than it is with a guy like Blake who scores from the perimeter and inside.
Yeah, and to his credit, Paul, the last couple of years, he's been deferring more, but he's always going to be Chris Paul. He's a point guard, and he's going to want the ball.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think a lot of people say, I think Charles Barkley said that Chris Paul is the best leader in the NBA. I'm not sure if that's true. I know Chris Paul, he postures himself as, and he has all the trappings of a great leader, and sort of carries himself and, barking at his guys. But I'm not sure if he really is, as far as building a team, is he what people think he is? So,
when you're up 3-1 like that, the best leader in the NBA doesn't let that happen. But, everything's not your fault, but I don't know if I can call you the best leader let's say you're the best captain, but if you captain the Titanic, I have to question your ability as a captain.
I try not to get into the whole, if he's so great, how can we never reach the second round? That's like that hot take, Twitter conversation
stuff.
Yeah,
too easy.
But, sooner or later, it's like, what do you – and guess what? It's not his fault. He played in the league with where LeBron James is and now Kevin Durant is. These guys are the best, and he's not them. He's just not, he's been beaten usually by better teams. So it's not his fault. He's still really good, but maybe he's just not, he's not Chris Paul. He's not LeBron James. He's not Kevin Durant. Russ Westbrook has that crazy game-changing athleticism. Steph Curry has that insane shooting. He might have been just cursed to be playing in the wrong time.
Let's go to the East and Kevin Love. He seems to be one of the hot trade topics.
So my thoughts on Kevin Love have swung back and forth across the barometer a little bit because I was a believer in his numbers and his play in Minnesota, and he was they mishandled building a team around him in Minnesota. That's you can't argue that. But now that I've seen him in Cleveland, I really figured that he'd do better in Cleveland, and he filled the Chris Bosh third option role. But I guess I didn't really take into account that he wouldn't be able to make that defensive impact. He needs a very specific team to build around him. So it's tough because, all these teams have cap room, they're going to have space. But what do you want to really give up to make Kevin Love your best player? That's what's really tough. Boston's in the mix. They have a lot of pieces. They have picks. They have cap space, so they can make it work. It's really tough because Cleveland's already so good. But, again, Golden State is making things so tough for everybody because if you're not good enough to beat them, and no one really is right now, it seems like championship is almost there to win, barring injuries, then what are you doing? So what can Cleveland really add? I'm gonna reverse field and I'm gonna throw the question to you.
what do you think should be moved for Kevin Love, and who do you think can do it?
That's a good question. I think for him, Boston seems like a natural fit, and I guess you get some wing defenders if they're willing to get her. But I don't know who they would actually be willing to give up. But I think a lot of these teams are overreacting because Golden State is so good that they're trying to make these moves, especially Cleveland. This is just your team, and you just have to play out the string and see what happens. I don't think you're going to magically find someone that can come in and guard Steph Curry and guard Klay Thompson or guard Draymond Green. Maybe you can make a small move, but yeah, I just don't even see. And for me, for Golden State, and we can—I mean, not Golden State, but Cleveland—we can have this philosophical argument. But I think the second person that the offense goes through should be Kevin Love and not Kyrie Irving. I think you already have LeBron, who's ISO heavy. Then we have Kyrie doing it. The offense becomes stagnant. I think it's a much better offense when you give Kevin Love his elbow touches and you let him get involved in things too, as opposed to just making him a standstill shooter.
Well, see, the problem with that is like, it sounds great, but we know the NBA is a very organic thing. And you got a point guard with the ball in his hands. You can't tell him, hey, you know, you're our young point guard. We need you to come down and don't do things unless, you know, you're the third option. It just doesn't work like that because Kyrie's going to be aggressive. He's going to look for his shot like he's done his whole career. But I like you make a good point. Like, maybe if the team was LeBron James and then Kevin Love and then, you know, maybe some other lesser point guard, you know, I think he'd put up a good, you know, 19 and 12 easily. But it's just the fact that they do have two ball-dominant guys in Kyrie and LeBron, they did a good job compiling the talent. I don't know if they got the right talent, you know, with those three.
I mean, I just don't think it fundamentally works. If you have two guys that are that ball-dominant, if you look at what they did in Miami, where Wade learned to play off the ball, it's not – I mean, if you want to win, you have to change. And Love to some degree too. But Kyrie, that team fundamentally to me, and my brother says four, but they have three guys that play superstar ball, which they want the ball in their hands and they want everything to revolve around them. Well, you can't, when you're on a championship team, you can't have three guys that play superstar ball. You got to have other guys that do the little things, they can move without the ball, and they don't run enough. I mean, some of the stuff is simple. They don't run enough Bron and Kevin Love pick and rolls. There's lots of stuff they could do to incorporate Kevin Love that they really don't do, or they could do that they just don't even care. I don't know.
Well, and the issue with that, I think, is the blessing and the curse of having a player like LeBron James. That Blatt, you know, that was just a perfect storm of a mess when they brought Blatt in and of LeBron, because LeBron does have vast knowledge, and he knows, hey, playing my way works. So when Blatt tried to institute the Princeton offense, I don't know if you remember, Kevin Love had a comment where he said, you know, this is borderline genius offense that we run. But the problem was LeBron didn't. Blatt didn't get LeBron on his side, therefore LeBron said, I'm going to be LeBron and do what we need to do to get to where we need to get, and that just kind of almost doomed Blatt from the start. And, you know, it is what it is. I mean, he's great, and he's going to get to the finals, but I hate sounding like a broken record. The way Golden State is right now, that might just not be enough.
I tend to agree, barring injury. Let's move to the Warriors. The Warriors have 17 home games remaining. They've got a crucial six-game road trip coming up where three of those games are on the road against the Clippers, the Hawks, and the Thunder. They need to finish 25-5 in order to get to 73 wins and beat the 95-96 Chicago Bulls record of 72-10. You think they can do it?
I think in a vacuum, sure. I would hope. Though when they hit about, you know, they hit about 18, 19 games, and if they're, you know, they maintain this kind of pace and they have a pretty good lead on San Antonio and whoever else, third, fourth, that Kerr does a smart thing and starts strategically resting guys. And the record should be a nice cherry on top of their season, and they should all go into the playoffs healthy and pretty well rested. It shouldn't be something that they drive for, you know, and they play guys long minutes towards the end. If they're up and they're winning and they get it, hey, it's definitely a possibility. So this team right now, as instructed, it's hard to beat, you know. I can't see I mean, look, they're like 40-something and 4 right now. You know, they start off 44-4 or whatever it was. So, yeah, they definitely can do it. I just hope they don't overexert themselves doing it.
The scary thing about them, and that's what I was thinking earlier in the season too, the scary thing about them is they don't necessarily play their A game, and they blow so many teams out that it's almost like they're not exerting themselves, which is scary. Granted, they played San Antonio and Oklahoma City twice combined, but just in general, even their C games, they still win, and they're blowing a lot of these teams out.
Well, it's easy to say that, and like that was, I don't know if you saw it, but Matt Moore, also known as HP Basketball on Twitter, real good follow, smart basketball guy. He was making a big thing about how at first he thought there's a chance they could run the table, and then, but I mean, no matter what we see, it's a grind every night getting up for an NBA basketball game. Even if Curry set out 15 fourth quarters, that means he's played into the fourth quarter in, you know, 40 games. It's a grind. He had a problem with his shins. I think Draymond had an ankle injury or something with his knee.
Yeah,
played just a few games. It's going to happen. It's no matter how much we say about them exerting themselves, to even get out to a huge lead in the first quarter takes effort. It takes a lot of, you know, effort to be an NBA basketball player. So, yes, they're going to be fresher than most teams come playoff time, but no matter what, come playoff times, you're tired and you're injured. There's no way to be, you know, let's say 80%, 90% then. It's a long season. So, yeah, they're going to be fresher than most, and they're young, they're energetic. I just hope Steve Kerr looks at what Pop does, even though he's a lot younger. And, I mean, strategically rest guys down the stretch. It doesn't matter. Like you said, they're good enough to bring their C game against most teams and beat them by 15. If it happens, it happens.
What team do you think matches? We both pretty much seem like we agree that they're probably going to end up winning again. But what team do you think matches up best with them in a series?
It's weird because we saw what Milwaukee did. Milwaukee can kind of grind them down and get big and gave them two really good games. But that's not a real, you know, matchup. I would say the Spurs. Spurs got blown out. I think, though, with just knowing Pop and the talent they have there, you got to give them a puncher's chance. OKC, they got back into the game, tied up late, but their execution was lacking, and the fact that they gave up so many points in the first half is troubling. It's just I mean, maybe we could say we saw what the Cavs did with no Kyrie and no Love. If they play, I mean, do you, you know, maybe even bench Kevin Love, give him, you know, 15, 20 minutes of that goal and then bench him and try to do what they did last year, except now they got, you know, Kyrie instead of Dellavedova running the point. So, yeah, LeBron's that good. Add Kyrie to that. Maybe Love can find a way to stay on the floor. But, yeah, OKC with KD and Russ just being so just damn awesome on their own, make it really hard against anybody in the series. But other than that, man, it's hard to see.
Are you seeing anything different from Oklahoma City this year? I know they fired Scott Brooks. They've got Donovan in there. And it still seems to me, when push comes to shove, they're going to go to that heavy ISO ball and try to make tough shots with Westbrook and Durant.
Yeah, and this is no fault of Billy Donovan's, unless he's Pop or at least he's Rick Carlisle, where he can come in and demand that kind of respect. These guys have been doing it for 7-8 years before he showed up. It's really hard to change the DNA of a player, like the makeup of a player who's been doing something his whole career in a few short months. So you can't really blame Billy Donovan. And when you have players that good, why not go ISO? But I have noticed that Russell Westbrook is having, you know, the best assist totals of his career. His usage is down. His shots are down since, I think after the first 20 games, he showed up. There's a marked difference. His turnovers are down. He's playing a lot more under control. And can you put that to the system or put that to maturation. I'm going to give Donovan the benefit of the doubt with that. Kevin Durant's being super efficient. He's actually set a lot of fourth quarters himself, and he's actually playing. His minutes are pretty much down. So I think Donovan's doing a good job of getting them to try to trust their teammates. I see Kevin Durant passing up shots to move the ball, trying to fit, you know, run the offense. They actually have some sets. I see they run some actually pretty clever sets, and at times their offense looks really good. But like you said, though, yeah, when things get tough and the other guys aren't hitting shots or the game's close at the fourth quarter, you know, you end up with KD up top and they're running four flat. And that's not good. But I think it's a work in progress, and their defense has been atrocious, which is kind of alarming because they have the same personnel with Serge and KD and Russ. But I give Donovan, hey, it's incomplete right now. It's a work in progress, though, and we see the guys making progress.
My thing with them, and of course, and you're looking at a team that probably has two of the top five players in the league. My thing with them is that you don't have to just shoot the ball in the clutch, in the crunch time. Like, you can create a shot. And a lot of times those guys, they don't trust their teammates. And granted, they don't have great shooters around them. But just in general, the ability that Michael Jordan, or even Michael Jordan, you will see many times in the with the game on the line, he passes to someone because he's creating a shot based on all the attention. But with those guys, I feel like they're just like, it's my turn. KD's like, it's my turn to shoot. Westbrook's like, it's my turn to shoot in the last 2 minutes, and this is what we're going to do no matter what.
And you're right. And like I said, I think it's really hard to break them of that habit, because that's what they've been doing for the last 7-8 years. That's what they're comfortable doing. I was talking to someone on Twitter today, and they said they're tired of KD being so unselfish because they think they want him to take some shots that are passing out. And I said, that's good. He's buying into the offense. He's trying to move the ball and empower the role players and get them taking shots. Then if they take them now, if they're missing, they won't be scared to take them in the moment. So that's a good thing. So I've noticed with KD, at least, throughout the course of the game, he's trying to get his teammates involved. And, yes, towards the end of the game, they might revert back to iso ball. But, I mean, that's him wanting to win the ball game. So it's a work in progress trying to get them to trust their teammates completely.
To me, the Cavaliers are looking for something that's just not going to happen. Golden State has moved into just almost, it feels like a new era of basketball. And I feel like LeBron and Cleveland are back in that old era where you take games off and some nights you just don't have the effort there. They don't really move the ball. And they're looking for all these trades and all these things to make it right. And just fundamentally, they're just not better than Golden State.
I agree with what you said. I don't think it's so much about the effort as far as the fact that LeBron knows he can't bring it every night anymore. Honestly, he's getting a little older. He's not old. He's not washed up, but he just knows how to pace himself. But you hit the nail on the head, because the game has evolved at such a breakneck speed. No one, if you told me 3 years ago Golden State would be some unbeatable team with Steph Curry averaging 30 a game, I would call you a liar. If you told me like 3 years ago Draymond Green would be the second most player on the best team, on a historically great team, I would have called you a liar. No one could have saw this coming, but now it's here. The teams have no counter for it. No team has a real counter for what they do. You can't double Steph, because Dre's going to kill you in the 4-on-3. You can't double Dre, because then Curry and Clay are going to just bomb away on you. Harrison Ford chips in hitting threes. Iggy hit threes. They're deep. They're versatile. And right now there's seemingly no answer for them. So Cleveland, they did the best job they could with the knowledge they had and the assets they had, and now it looks like it just might not be enough. And me and you both said it, and we're gonna just sound almost like, you know, we're homers or whatever. I'm not a Cleveland fan. I mean, I'm not a Golden State fan. It's just that right now they're head and shoulders better than anyone else in the league, and until somebody shows me that they can beat them 4 games out of 7, I don't see it being done.
Yeah, I tend to agree. What have you seen, depending on how closely you watched them since Tyronn Lue has coached, but have you seen any difference between Lue and Blatt and how the teams played?
I haven't really watched, I'll admit it. I just haven't really watched too much. But from what I'm hearing, it's funny, right after it happened, he said he wanted to pick the pace up. And I know that at least, a week, maybe a week afterwards, they were playing at a slower pace than they had been playing under Blatt. And another thing, this is not what I've seen, but I wish I could credit who I read it from. He's holding guys accountable in the film room, where Blatt would kind of a shy away from, you know, critiquing LeBron's effort or play. He's freezing the film and he's saying, "Hey, Bron, you got to get back here. You got to do this here." So that's a positive. He's not playing favorites, but at the same time, he was kind of handpicked by Bron, from my feeling about it. So he kind of is a favorite. It is what it is, though, man. They have LeBron James, who is right during a five in a series will be the most influential player on the floor. But they don't, other than Kyrie and Kevin Love, they don't have a lot of guys. My big thing with Jarrett Smith is if you're depending on Jarrett Smith, then you're going home, because I don't trust him. I don't believe in him. You know,
yeah,
so
it's very hard to believe in him. But to me, you know, JR will give you let's say he'll give you a game and a half or a game and a quarter in every series. But Shumpert, I just don't understand. Maybe it's injuries, but I was disappointed with him in the finals. And this year, the injuries, but he has not been what I feel like what they thought he would be.
I just read today that there was, you know, trade talk, they're trying to move him too. And there's talk about him being disinterested or him maybe being more interested in off-court things than being a great basketball player. And I don't know. I don't know if that's just those are just rumors, but I think Shumpert has always been more potential than actual production ever since he was, you know, first the Knicks made him untouchable because he's going to be the next two-way wing. And then, you know, injuries, he had some injuries, but we've never seen Shump just be really good for an extended period of time. And I think we might be seeing that this is who he is. He might just not pan out to be a great player. He might be a nice role player, somebody, you know, maybe, but he just might not be that good. So I think we're starting to I think people are starting to realize that about him.
I agree. We saw Kobe Bryant over the All-Star weekend basically get his up-teeth going away celebration. From what I've seen of you, you are a Kobe realist, and I tend to be a Kobe realist too. But his fans, as you know and I know, are very diehard. What do you think is Kobe Bryant's legacy?
Kobe's. You know what? My thing with Kobe, I'm a self-professed Kobe hater. Being that I respect what he's done, but his legacy is when Michael Jordan left, there was a void, a superstar void left. There was plenty of talent in the NBA, but there was no it guy. Even with Shaq, everyone else, Kobe stepped in and he became that larger-than-life player. Even if his game didn't quite stack up like Mike's did. So he's a fantastic scorer. You can't take 81 away from him. He was polarizing. He was, you know, at times, he's one of those guys you either love or hate. A lot of people hate him. A lot of people love him. He definitely made his name as a top, I always say he's, you know, top 15 player in the NBA. And at the same time, he has probably the most rabid fan base we're ever going to see. So he's made his impact. His sneakers are up there, one of the best sellers. I always say it's a sincerest form of flattery to copy, you know, to get copied, and then for him to be an imitation of the best ever in Michael Jordan, but still blaze the trail for himself says a lot. So he's an all time great, man. I personally wasn't a fan of his, not just because I'm a Celtics fan and he was a Laker. I didn't like his demeanor, and I think even as great as he was, he was overrated by some of his fans and even some other players. Hey, you know, he's right behind Mike. No, he's not. But he's not even close.
Right. I've heard people, his most rabid fans would say number two. And I'm like, are you crazy in your head to think Kobe Bryant is the second greatest player of all time?
Exactly. He's great, but when I see people put him in the top five all time, no, he's not. But it's also funny to see people say, like, say insult to say that, you know, at 15 – he's better than, you know, I guess there's been 4,000 and something NBA players in history. And I'm saying he's one of the 15 best. That's a pretty high compliment in anybody's mind, it should be.
Yeah, I think ESPN in their list, which is pretty controversial, had him at 12, I think. I would probably put him at 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there. But if that's not far from 10 to 15, that's not a far cry, which basically everyone says he's a top 15 player that ever played the game. So you can't sign many people that will say put him outside the top 15.
And if you put him outside the top 15, then you probably just don't really like him. But I don't like him, but I'm going to say I have him. I think I have him 12. And, you know, somebody was arguing with me very passionately about how, if he's not your top 10, then you're crazy. I said, well, 12 is right beside 10, bro. It's not that big a difference.
Yeah, it's not that far. Two spots down from the number 10.
It's
not crazy.
It's right there.
How you view people like Jerry West and Elgin Baylor and people like that, I think, there's some debate, and you can look at Kobe's unique because of those three titles where at least two, he was a Robin. So it's what you do with those two championships, or to some people three, but I definitely know for two, he was a Robin there.
On that third, when they were one and one alpha, they were, you know, up there together. And my thing, I mean, let me ask you this. Can you tell me what year or years was Kobe Bryant hands down the best player in the NBA?
It's really hard because
we had the conversation on Twitter too, and people were trying to say, 2007, 2008, and I said, well, you know, Look at Dirk that year. Look at, you know, Tim Duncan that year. There's always somebody that I can make an argument for being just as good or better than Kobe in any season. You know, and I think from 2008 on, it was all about LeBron. He's been unequivocally the best player in the league since 2008 up until maybe this year when Steph Curry just kind of stormed the scene. But you can't really say that about
Kobe.
No time
had
you look
run
at
of 8 years, 5 years, where he was just undisputed the guy. I think maybe there are 3 years. Around those, when Shaq left, and they got to the playoffs against the Suns, and he scored 81, maybe 3 or 4 years in there where people feel like, which God knows, they never shut up about Nash stealing his MVPs, Kobe fans. But So definitely those 2 years with Nash, maybe. I think one of those, Shaq, he was with Shaq on the Lakers. But, yeah, it's hard. It's murky. You're right.
It is very murky. If you look at it, it's maybe 2, 3, maybe 4 years where he was undisputed. Yeah, depending on how you look at it, where he was undisputed. And that's not – it's not the same as LeBron, who's had almost a decade almost.
Exactly. And even, like I said, even those 3 or 4 years, like, Dirk won the MVP in 2007 for a reason. Dirk was amazing that year. You know, Tim Duncan – in 2004 and 2005, they won the championship in 2005, and Tim Duncan was insane. He's never been flashy like Kobe, but he's been such an awesome defender. 2006, 2007, Dwayne Wade was right there, too. Dwayne Wade was incredible. You know, he was averaging like 27, 6, and 7 or something that year. He was amazing. So, I mean, there's always somebody right there with him. But it's interesting. The fact that we're even having this conversation speaks volumes about how great Kobe was.
Part of Kobe's problem is that when he was at the peak of his powers, his team was not good, and that hurts. That's why he only has one MVP. People are always like, well, he should have gotten Nash's MVP because he averaged 34 points a game, and he scored 34 – I mean, and he scored 81. Well, what MVPs do you know in the history of basketball? How many times has the MVP been on a 7th or 8th place team? You know, they just
never.
Don't do that. So you can't change the rules of basketball for – and I'm sure the Kobe haters – I try to be realistic about Kobe. I'm not a Kobe hater, people listening to the podcast, but I'm going to be realistic about it. You had what I thought was a funny incident, whereas I even forgot that it was you before I asked for the podcast, and I remember. you had a funny incident with a Kobe hater. Can you tell us that story?
That's when I really found out how insane they were. It was basically Christmas Day. All the games were on, and I saw someone being retweeted, you know, just saying how Kobe was in the midst of, I think it was before he got injured, before the second injury, I think, the season ending one. You know, he already had the Achilles, and I think this was before maybe the kneecap. I'm not sure, but either way, he was averaging like 20-5, and he was shooting like 35%, and some guy was calling him elite. You know, what an elite player he still is, and I just said, this is stupid. And, you know, his reaction was pretty, you know, he kind of started, you know, this is a family radio show, I think, so I'm not going to. But anyway, the reaction was way over the top. But, I mean, you know, he tried to argue in a pretty ignorant way to my any facts I was asserting. And, I started actually messing with him, and, you know, he wasn't very bright. So it was pretty easy. I was talking circles around him. And then finally, I said something that really set him off, and he wanted to fight. So I was in Arizona with my family. So I told him, yeah, I'll come meet you in Temecula to fight, even though, you know, my very next tweet was, I hope he thinks I'm, you know, I'm in Arizona. And the rest of the day, I guess he drove on Christmas Day down to Temecula from wherever he lived.
That's the scariest thing, that it was on Christmas Day and he did it. That was the most damning
thing. Funny, that's the funniest part because, I mean, I'm you know, 400 miles away with my family. And even here's the thing, I don't know what other people's lives are like, but even if I was living in Temecula, I'm not leaving my house to fight somebody over basketball and over Twitter. It's ridiculous. So, it became a big thing. A lot of news outlets picked it up and stuff, and it's funny because I think he went on Huffington Post Live and said that he was being bullied and he had to stand up for himself or something like that.
Oh, really? That was his.
Oh, yeah.
He went on a liberal outlet and went that way. But that's not what he was talking about on Twitter. He was like, this is about men and men handle their business.
Oh, you call me not real.
Oh,
and
he's blocking, right?
You know,
he's blocking, right? He's not listening to this. You blocked. That was the funniest part.
So I doubt he'll meet me in Nebraska. But
so he had a mixtape drop the next day, and he, you know.
Oh God,
So I can probably say I'm like I'm the only basketball blogger that has a diss track aimed at him. So that's one of my claims to fame.
That's pretty special. Yeah, that story is just, oh man, that was, I even saw Bomani Jones talk about it on his Twitter. It was all up, Deadspin picked it up. Yeah, it definitely was a, what was the reaction to it? Like what was it like being for a few, I don't know, for a day or two, being like the eye of the internet kind of thing, eye of the internet?
Oh, it was a pain in the butt. It wasn't, after 15 minutes, it wasn't fun anymore because my notifications are going nuts. I got people, calling me to be on the news and ask me for interviews, and it was a pain in the butt, man. It really was. But at the end of the day, I had people, other people, his little hit lackeys, threaten me and trying to talk, same stuff. But it was a pain in the butt. But it's always funny, and it's funny because my name, I'm known for that. I wish I was known for being a better basketball writer, but I'll take it.
Yeah, it's a start. Before we go, let me let me ask you about your Celtics. What's the general state of the Celtics right now, since that's your team?
Celtics, Ainge did a great job of asset acquisition. Players 1 through 8, you can go 8 or 9 deep with no real drop-off, and that's their strength. When other teams go to their bench, Boston can make hay because their 5 on the floor will be better than the other team's bench on the floor. They're still looking for that big trade. They're looking for they want to move a lot of pieces or picks to get a real deal star in town. Because that's what they're missing. They have a lot of really high level role players, with Isaiah Thomas even being an all-star this year. But I think it's more of a situational thing than actually him. But he's good. He's a good player. There's a lot of good players, but they're looking to make that big splashy move to actually make themselves contenders. And my take never changed. I don't know why they got Isaiah Thomas and decided to make the playoffs last season, when they were, they were in the running for a Justice Winslow or Booker or Miles Turner. But hey, we are where we are now, which is, it's a good position. They have cap space. They have assets.
All right, last question to hit you out on this. Give me your All NBA team for the halfway mark, first and second, I guess.
All right, first team, one guard, of course, Steph Curry. I got two guard positions. I'm not going to go shooting guard. My second guard will be Russ Westbrook. Three, I got to be realistic. I love Kevin Durant, but I think LeBron is still going to be – I'll still go LeBron. LeBron for my one forward. Second forward, I go Kevin Durant. And big man, I'm going to give Boogie Cousins his props. He's been playing amazing this year. Team two, Chris Paul. I'd probably go Jimmy Butler. Even though he's injured, I love his game. Kawhi Leonard, this is tough. Brown's still up there, but he's kind of, I don't know. I think he got to get bowled this season. Power forward or another forward, this is tough.
I guess you could get Paul George or the Brow, or I guess depends on where you want to say his usage is at this year.
I'm gonna respect Brown still, and I'm gonna put him there at power forward. And then honestly, I'm gonna reach for the center. I'm gonna go Karl-Anthony Towns. He's been amazing. He's probably been the second best center in the league, honestly, this season. Dwight's been in and out and ineffective, and now Mark Gasol is gone. So I'll go.
No love for Drummond.
Been actually spectacular. Yeah.
No love for Drummond.
Drummond started off the season amazing, and he's kind of tailed off a little bit. And his terrible field goal percentage in a lot of games, as big as he is and athletic as he is, he shouldn't be shooting like 50%. He should be up there 55, 56, 50. He missed a lot of bunnies. He blows a lot of stuff. So I love him. I love his game. And I can give him 13. But I'm going to go Karl-Anthony Towns.
Where do you see Kawhi at right now? I see you put him on your second team, but a lot of people are saying I've always felt like that people have they've jumped on the Kawhi bandwagon too quickly, and I think this is the actual year where you should be jumping on he's the elite player bandwagon. But how do you see him?
I see him as being elite, and I also see him – both of these things can be true. He's elite, but he's also beneficiary of being a Spur. Because as good as he is, on the nights when he's not great, it's not very noticeable because they have so many other weapons and because they are the Spurs. Everything Spurs related to me is its own atmosphere.
You can't make comparisons and say, oh, look what the Spurs did, so this other team should do it. They're the Spurs. They're on their own planet. So he's elite. He's right there. You know, I've heard him say top five. I'm not going to argue. He can be a top four or five player in the league. He's awesome. But he also has the safety net of being a Spur. So it's not his fault, and it's not taking anything away from him because he's great. So, yeah, anywhere between he's up there. He's top I'd say the top five player this season.
All right, James, this was great. Tell everybody where they can find your work and where they can find you on Twitter.
Hey, man, I really appreciate you having me on. It's funny, I'm a big Scottie Pippen fan, one of my favorite players. So the play on his name is, you know, Snotty Drippin. Spelled like Scottie Pippen with Snotty Drippin in it. and then you can read me at bballbreakdown.com. A lot of real deal writers, a lot way better than me, so it's worth your time.
Excellent website.
Yeah, you'll learn a lot. It's a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun there. So, appreciate you having me on, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, no problem, man. I appreciate it.